content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the June 30th, 2017 issue of the Week magazine. The cover this week is interesting. I will try to give you a picture of it. It's got two crowds facing each other and kind of obviously angry, screaming. And in the foreground are two individual men. On the right-hand side is a guy with a red baseball cap and sunglasses and his jaws set. And he's just inches away from a guy with a hoodie pulled up over his head, and he's got on a blue bandana and a blue American flag on his forehead, and they're just grimacing at each other. And the title says, "A Culture of Rage. Are Red and Blue America Headed for a Divorce?" And with that, we'll go to the main stories and how they were covered. Trump goes on attack against special counsel. What happened? President Trump and his surrogates have begun challenging the legitimacy of special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into whether his campaign colluded with Russia, labeling the probe a witch hunt tainted by partisan politics. The Washington Post reported last week that Mueller is also looking into whether the president obstructed justice in his dealings with ousted FBI Director James Comey, prompting Trump to respond with a furious tweet storm. "I am being investigated for firing the FBI director," Trump tweeted. "You are witnessing the single greatest witch hunt in American political history, led by some very bad and conflicted people." The president's surrogates and lawyers say four members of Mueller's team of 13 prosecutors and investigators have made donations to Democrats, and that Mueller himself and Comey were former Justice Department colleagues and friends. Aides told the Associated Press that Trump believes he is the victim of a Democratic conspiracy to oust him from the White House and yells at the TV every time Mueller's investigation is mentioned. "He believes this is a political fight, and he's going to fight it," said a White House official. Vice President Mike Pence, Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions have all hired personal lawyers for the Russia investigation. Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who is facing possible criminal charges for lying to FBI agents about his Russian contacts and failing to disclose payments from Russia and Turkey, may now be cooperating with the FBI, said two Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is also investigating the Russia allegations. "All the signals are suggesting that Flynn is already cooperating with the FBI," said Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. "It could be a huge deal." What the editorial said: Trump's worst problems are of his own making, said the Washington Examiner. Incapable of dialing down his combativeness, Trump recklessly fired Comey, and in doing so, escalated the urgency and scope of the investigation he wished to make go away, and made himself a target of possible obstruction charges. "The president's attempts to discredit Mueller will fall flat," said the Washington Post. The special counsel, appointed FBI director by Republican President George W. Bush, is a decorated combat veteran with a spotless track record as a public servant. He is so well respected that his 10-year term as FBI director was extended for an extra 2 years on a unanimous Senate vote. "You don't have to be a Trump partisan to have concerns about where all of this is headed," said the Wall Street Journal. The FBI began its investigation under Comey last summer, But so far, there's no evidence that Trump's team colluded with Russia's attempt to meddle in the 2016 election through its hacking of Democratic officials' emails. Yet Mueller's probe has now reportedly widened to include not just obstruction, but both Trump and Kushner's financial dealings. As Mueller's team of aggressive prosecutors and investigators keeps growing, there is a growing sense that they will keep looking under rocks until they find some reason to nail someone. What the columnist said. Liberals should remember the unfairness of the Whitewater investigation, said David Brooks in the New York Times. It started out with a special prosecutor examining an Arkansas land deal involving the Clintons and wound up 6 years later as an investigation into whether President Bill Clinton had had an affair with an intern. If Trump or his aides colluded with Russia, they deserve to be prosecuted for treason. But the left keeps assuming, without evidence, that such collusion existed, hoping that the politics of scandal will destroy the Trump presidency. Trump's fury over the investigation is not an indication of guilt, said Nicholas Waddy in DailyCaller.com. He believes liberals are using it to delegitimize his November victory. His increasingly exasperated behavior is exactly the sort of reaction you would expect from an innocent man who can't believe the underhandedness of his political enemies. If the president is innocent, then he is insane, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. Trump's increasingly erratic behavior makes sense if it comes from a rational fear of what Mueller's probe may reveal, such as unscrupulous dealings with Russian banks, or his circle's many secretive conversations with Russian emissaries. But if Trump has nothing to hide, he is clearly suffering from an obsessive disorder that renders him helplessly self-destructive. Either way, it's hard to see how he is fit for high office. Trump's staff and lawyers are surely begging him to stop tweeting out attacks on Mueller and his team, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. It's utterly insane for the president to antagonize the people investigating him, but he simply can't bear to have someone he can't control have such power over his fate. As Mueller digs deeper and more broadly into Team Trump's tangled alliance with Russia, and even gets hold of Trump's tax returns, the higher the chances are that Trump will, in a moment of rage, order Mueller to be fired. If you think this situation is crazy now, just wait. It's going to get worse. Our controversy of the week, political violence. Is America headed for a divorce? The neighbors of a mass shooter can usually be counted on to mumble shell-shocked cliches about how normal he seemed, said Christopher Ingram in WashingtonPost.com. But after James Hodgkinson opened fire last week on House Republicans as they practiced for a baseball game, one of his Belleville, Illinois neighbors made a comment that speaks volumes about political culture in the United States. The neighbor said he rarely spoke to Hodgkinson for one simple reason. He was a Democrat and I was a Republican, so we didn't have too much to talk about. This is what America has become in 2017, a land where we are partisans first and neighbors second. We're now a nation where more than 40% of Republicans and Democrats say the other party is a threat to the nation's well-being, and where seething extremists like Hodgkinson, who constantly vented his partisan bile on his Facebook page, are so commonplace that no one bats an eyelid until the first shots ring out. Hostilities between militant liberals and resentful traditionalists have been intensifying for decades, said J. Robert Smith in AmericanThinker.com. As summer comes on, is that long, cold civil war about to finally turn hot? Americans may seem polarized and violent at the moment, said Jeet here in NewRepublic.com, but that's because we always have been. Let's not forget that this nation was founded on the mass slaughter of Native Americans and the sweat of slaves dragged here in chains and whipped into subservience. We've endured a civil war that cost more than 600,000 lives and countless race riots, racial murders, and politically motivated bombings. Four of our presidents were assassinated, and many more survived thwarted attempts. Violence is part of our collective political DNA, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. America was born in the bloodshed of the Revolution, and we've always had rabid ideologues with fervent faith in the purifying value of guns, ropes, and bombs. It may be small comfort, but the hateful rhetoric and violence surrounding us are hardly aberrations or unique to the Trump era. Previous generations had their differences, said Niall Stanage in TheHill.com, but they didn't have the internet or cable TV. Today, Americans choose their news from sources that conform with their existing ideological leanings, then get further hardened in their positions by the echo chambers of social media. The result is that extremists now dominate the debate, and partisan enmity continues to grow. Our political tribes really do fear and loathe each other, said Emily Badger and Niraj Chokshi in NYTimes.com. A Pew poll last year found that 68% of Republicans and 62% of Democrats are motivated less by their party's ideas than by the fear the other party's policies would ruin the country. This won't end well, said David French in NationalReview.com. But it needn't be bloody. Red and blue America are already sorting themselves into distinct geographical areas, which may provide some grim hope. More likely than a second civil war is a national divorce, in which the two sides embrace strong states' rights and live by their own laws and more in ideological homogeneous enclaves. It's too soon to give up on the idea of a politically diverse America, said Kevin Williamson, also in NationalReview.com. But we all have some work to do, starting with a simple acknowledgement that our political opponents are as American and well-intentioned as we are. In such angry times, it can be easy to forget that nobody said being free would be easy. It was a good week for Louis the Lobster after the 22-pound crustacean, believed to be 132 years old, was released into the Atlantic Ocean after spending the past two decades in a tank at a Long Island restaurant. It was a good week for Straight Talk after a Russian Orthodox Church leader who's friends with Vladimir Putin declared that men should stop shaving to protect themselves from homosexuality. Metropolitan Cornelie said, "The Lord created everyone with a beard, and that shaving makes men weak and effeminate." It was a good week for extreme makeovers, after Mattel unveiled its updated line of Ken dolls featuring two body types, seven different skin tones, and nine new hairstyles, including cornrows, a fade, and a man bun. But it was a bad week for Grand Theft Avocado after three California men were charged with stealing $300,000 worth of avocados from the produce plant where they worked. "Everybody loves avocados," a Ventura County sheriff said. "We take these kinds of threats seriously." It was a bad week for a side of fries after researchers in Italy revealed that study subjects who ate French fries two or more times a week were at double the risk of an early death compared with those who didn't. The frequent consumption of fried potatoes appears to be associated with an increased mortality risk, the researchers concluded. And it was a bad week for history lessons. After President Trump boasted about the U.S.'s construction of the Panama Canal during an Oval Office meeting with Panamanian President Juan Carlos Varela. "I think we did a good job of building it, right?" Trump said, prompting Varela to respond, "Yeah, 100 years ago. Onto the briefing page, Russia's online offensive. Vladimir Putin's regime is weaponizing the internet to sow chaos, confusion, and discord across the West. What is Russia doing? It's conducting a global disinformation campaign of unprecedented scope. Russia's interference in last year's U.S. election, when hackers stole and released emails from high-profile Democrats, wasn't an isolated incident. Kremlin-linked hackers have been active in French and German elections, promoting far-right parties. They are also believed to be behind the hack of Qatar's state news agency last month, when made-up quotes from the country's leader, expressing support for Israel and Iran, sparked a diplomatic crisis with Saudi Arabia. In addition to hacking, the Kremlin has also launched a relentless propaganda campaign, deploying armies of internet trolls to spread conspiracy theories and attack Russia's critics. Foreign policy analysts believe Vladimir Putin, a former KGB operative, wants to destabilize and divide the West so it cannot threaten his autocratic rule or expansionist ambitions. Defense Secretary James Mattis told a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing last week that Putin is aggressively trying to break any kind of multilateral alliance that is a stabilizing influence in the world and disrupt the international order. Is this a new strategy? Disinformation and propaganda have been around for decades. Moscow has in the past successfully spread rumors that the U.S. government ordered the killing of Martin Luther King and created the AIDS virus to kill gays and blacks. But new technology has made the process of spreading false information infinitely easier. Russia now has its own 24-hour news organization, RT, broadcasting in more than 100 countries. Its sister outlet, Sputnik, churns out propaganda in more than 30 languages. Sample headline, "Everyone I spoke with in Crimea wanted to secede from Ukraine." These organizations, backed by hundreds of unofficial Moscow-sponsored blogs, twist or fabricate stories to fit their anti-Western agenda. Their global reach is impressive. Since its launch in 2007, RT's YouTube channel has had 1.8 billion views, more than CNN's. What else is Russia doing? The Kremlin has recruited an estimated 1,000 full-time online trolls to boost its propaganda efforts. In tandem with thousands of botnets, networks of computers that have been hijacked without their owner's knowledge, these online provocateurs flood blogs, social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter, and the comment sections of news sites with Moscow's messaging. These troll farms fiercely defend Russia from its critics, often by accusing the West of hypocrisy, spreading lies and innuendo about mainstream politicians, and bolster anti-establishment figures such as Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and French right-winger Marine Le Pen. "The Kremlin doesn't have a preference in terms of right or left," said Ben Nimmo of the Atlantic Council, a Washington-based think tank. "It has a preference in terms of useful or hostile. The Kremlin even uses Americans' online footprints to target those who might be particularly susceptible to propaganda." How does it do that? By harnessing the vast reams of user information collected by the likes of Twitter, Facebook, and Google. Much of this data, what an individual likes or has a strong reaction to, is available commercially, allowing Russia to target people with opinion pieces or fake news stories that might appeal to them. U.S. soldiers, for example, are shown footage of Russian troops actually acting heroically against terrorists in Syria. Anti-immigration or anti-capitalist bloggers, reporters, or Facebook activists are targeted with stories playing to their ideological leanings. The aim is to get useful idiots to spread false or misleading stories unwittingly. They don't try to win the argument, said Michael McFaul, a former U.S. ambassador to Russia. It's to make everything seem relative. It's kind of an appeal to cynicism. Is this proving effective? Very. Ahead of the U.S. election, Russian trolls successfully spread false claims that Hillary Clinton helped run a pedophile ring from the basement of a Washington pizza parlor. In France, they circulated rumors that candidate Emmanuel Macron was gay and secretly funded by Saudi Arabia. Non-political disinformation is often designed to undermine NATO, such as recent fake reports that German soldiers stationed in Lithuania had raped a local teenager. Putin and his cronies argue that the CIA also has a history of spreading disinformation to undermine regimes in countries such as Cuba and Iran. If we do propaganda, Sputnik boss Dmitry Kiselyov recently told Western journalists, then you do propaganda too. What's being done to counter the Russians? Estonia, the target of Russia's first major cyber attack in 2007, has a Russian language TV channel dedicated to countering Moscow's aggressive disinformation efforts. In Washington, the government-funded Broadcasting Board of Governors recently launched a similar service, and the FBI is reportedly investigating whether the far-right news sites Breitbart.com and Infowars.com have helped Russia spread disinformation. Big tech firms are starting to clamp down. Facebook, which recently closed 30,000 French accounts for spreading fake news, now allows users to flag false stories. Google has adjusted its algorithms to prioritize reputable news sources. But after Russia's successful interference in the U.S. election, no one doubts Moscow will continue its campaign to sabotage democracy. They're coming after America, former FBI Director James Comey told senators earlier this month, and they will be back. Moving into the best columns now, we'll read one from the U.S. The GOP's healthcare muddle. Are congressional Republicans about to walk into a trap of their own making? Asked Jonathan Bernstein. Virtually every Republican in Congress ran on repealing and replacing Obamacare, but the party never came up with a coherent plan that could fulfill its grandiose promises of better care for less money. So now the Senate is trying to rush through a bill in secret that will almost certainly be highly unpopular. All indications are that the legislation will reduce subsidies to people buying policies on the exchanges, raise their deductibles, and force states to push millions of low-income people off Medicaid. Nearly $1 trillion in Obamacare taxes on the wealthy will be cut. The political cost of this symbolic victory could be very high. Just as with Obamacare, Trump care will be blamed for everything that goes wrong with anyone's health care. Unlike with Obamacare, most people will see their benefits reduced. The results could easily contribute to electoral disaster for the party in the 2018 and 2020 elections. If Republicans are lucky, they won't get the necessary 50 votes in the Senate. It'll be a political embarrassment, but not nearly as damaging as taking permanent ownership of a Trump care plan that few people like. This is from the United Kingdom. Tower fire ignites national anger. The apartment tower fire that killed at least 79 people in the heart of London has exposed the shameful inequality at the heart of British society, said the Observer in an editorial. The 24-story Grenfell Tower was built in 1974 as public housing for the poor, an ugly building in the middle of Kensington, one of the richest boroughs in one of the richest cities in the world. Residents had complained for years about inadequate fire safety measures, too few exits, no external fire escape, no sprinkler system. Each time they were rebuffed by an indifferent local council controlled by Britain's ruling Conservative Party. When a fire broke out at night in an apartment last week, it took just 15 minutes for the flames to ignite the building's exterior cladding, trapping residents on the upper floors. Some leaped, burning, to their deaths. Others succumbed in their homes. More bodies will likely be found in the coming weeks. The negligence that doomed dozens of men, women, and children to burn to death must forever be a stain on our conscience. Austerity did this, said Patrick Coburn in independent.co.uk. Under the pressure from the miserly Conservative government, local councils, which oversee public housing in their areas, now relentlessly cut costs and corners wherever possible. The material used for Grenfell's exterior paneling, installed as part of a renovation completed last year, is banned for use on tall buildings in the U.S. and Germany because it easily catches fire. But the cladding was approved for Grenfell because it cost about $6,300 less in total than a flame-resistant version. It is shocking and disgusting how the Conservative Party, in power for the past 7 years, deregulated the building industry with the excuse that they were cutting red tape, while at the same time strangling the weakest, poorest, and most vulnerable people with red tape by making it even more difficult to claim even basic benefits. The Grenfell victims are martyrs who died because of austerity, deregulation, and outsourcing. Grenfell will be remembered as Prime Minister Theresa May's Hurricane Katrina, said Adam Bolton in the Times. Just as President George W. Bush looked uncaring and clueless when he flew over a flooded New Orleans in 2005, so did May appear stiffly insensitive when, on her first visit to the scene, she failed to meet with survivors or victims' families. When she returned to meet them the next day, she was greeted with cries of murderer and coward. What a contrast with opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn, seen hugging people warmly, or the royal family who, perhaps sensing a leadership vacuum, have become the nation's consolers in chief. That's why conservatives are getting more vocal about ousting May, said David Wooding in The Sun. Already tarred by the party's poor showing in this month's snap election, in which the Conservatives lost their parliamentary majority, May has again exposed her dismal leadership skills. The number of Conservative parliamentarians ready to stick the knife into her is growing by the day. In one international column from Iraq, it's time for the Kurds to declare independence. Iraqi Kurds will soon decide whether they want their own nation, said Ayub Nouri. Masoud Barzani, the president of Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region, announced earlier this month that a referendum will be held in September on declaring independence from Baghdad. About a dozen Kurdish parties and factions were consulted over the vote. Yet some Kurds are still concerned that such a referendum would lead to the establishment of a dictatorial state. Others say that we are destined for democracy, but only if we build our country slowly, assembling a perfect constitution, a strong economic infrastructure, and a functioning parliament before seeking independence. These concerns are misplaced. It's not as if the country we are currently part of, Iraq, is particularly democratic or free of corruption. Who cares at this stage what kind of state Kurdistan will be? Sure, it would be great to have strong institutions and high standards of living, but the first step is to have a state at all. Right now, Kurds put almost every major decision on hold, whether building a highway or a dam or a family home, because we have almost no control over what happens next. Once we declare independence, the Kurds will finally have breathing space and a chance to invest in their own future. Move on to the last word now, our in-depth article this week titled, After the Gunfire Ends. Over the past two decades, more than 135,000 American students have experienced a shooting at their school, said journalist John Woodrow Cox. In one small town, first graders remain haunted by what they saw. Recess had finally started, so Ava Olson picked up her chocolate cupcake, then headed outside toward the swings. And that's when the 7-year-old saw the gun. It was black and in the hand of someone the first graders on the playground would later describe as a thin, towering figure with wispy blonde hair and angry eyes. Dressed in dark clothes and a baseball cap, he had just driven up in a Dodge Ram. It was 1:41 on a balmy blue sky afternoon in late September of last year, and Ava's class was just emerging from an open door directly in front of him to join the other kids already outside. Then he pulled the trigger. I hate my life, the children heard him scream. In the same moment, he added Townville Elementary in Townville, South Carolina, to the long list of American schools redefined by a shooting. A round struck the shoulder of Ava's teacher, who was standing at the green metal door before she yanked it shut. Near the cubbies inside, 6-year-old Colin Edwards felt his foot vibrate, then burn, as if he had stepped in a fire. A bullet had blown through the inside of his right ankle and popped out beneath his big toe, punching a hole in the sole of his Velcro strap sneaker. As his teacher pulled him away from the windows, Colin recalled later, he spotted a puddle of blood spreading across the gray tile floor in the hallway. Someone else, he realized, had been hurt too. Outside, Ava had dropped her cupcake. The Daisy Scout remembered what her mom had said. If something doesn't feel right, run. She sprinted toward the far side of the building, rounding a corner to safety. Nowhere in sight, though, was Jacob Hall, the tiny boy with oversized, thick-lensed glasses Ava had decided to marry when they grew up. He had been just a few steps behind her at the door, but she never saw him come out. Ava hoped he was okay. Standing on the wood chips near a yellow tube slide, Sienna Kibilko felt stunned. Until that moment, her most serious concern had been which How to Train Your Dragon toy she would get for her upcoming 7th birthday. Run, Sienna heard a teacher shouting, and she did. Carson Robinson, one of the biggest kids in class, hadn't waited for instructions. At the initial sound of gunshots, he scrambled over a fence on the opposite side of the playground. He then turned back to the school and found his classmates banging on a door. Let us in, Sienna begged, and the kids were hustled inside. The gunfire had stopped by then, and in a room on the other side of the school, Colin had discovered the source of all that blood. Sprawled on the floor was Jacob, the boy Ava adored. At 3.5 feet tall, he was the smallest child in first grade, everyone's kid brother. On the green swings at recess, Colin would call him Little Jay because that always made Jacob cackle in a way that made everyone else laugh, too. But now his eyes were closed, and Colin wondered if they would ever open again. "Look at me," a teacher urged Colin, but the boy couldn't stop staring at his friend. On a gray wall inside Townville Elementary's front lobby hangs a framed dream catcher, and beneath its blue beads and brown feathers is a Native American phrase, "Let us see each other again." It was among hundreds of items, letters, ornaments, photos, posters, plush toys, that deluged the school of 290 students after the September 28th attack. But the dream catcher held some special meaning. It had been sent to four other schools ravaged by gun violence, and the names of each were listed on the back. Columbine High in Colorado, Red Lake High in Minnesota, Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut, Marysville Pilchuck High in Washington State. In each shooting's wake, the children and adults who die and those who murder them become the focus of intense national attention. Often overlooked, though, are the students who survive the violence but are profoundly changed by it. Beginning with Columbine 18 years ago, more than 135,000 students attending at least 164 primary or secondary schools have experienced a shooting on campus, according to a Washington Post analysis. That doesn't count dozens of suicides, accidents, and after-school assaults that have also exposed children to gunfire. "A meaningful number of those kids are going to have significant struggles," said Bruce Perry, a psychiatrist who worked with families from Columbine and Sandy Hook. "It's stunning how one event can have this echo that will impact so many more individuals than people realized. Every child reacts differently to violence at school," therapists have found. "Some students, either immediately or later, suffer post-traumatic stress similar to combat veterans returning from war. Many grapple with recurring nightmares, are crippled by everyday noises, struggle to focus in classes, and fear the shooter will come after them again." Because of the lasting damage, Townville's teachers, administrators, first responders, counselors, pastors, and parents, and their children agreed to speak about what the community of 4,000 has endured over the past 9 months. They'd always felt safe in this swath of countryside, which claims a single spot stoplight, but at least six churches. Overwhelmingly white, it is home to families that have farmed for decades. Retirees with lake houses, college-educated professionals, and hundreds of people in mobile homes living from one paycheck to the next. What connects them is a beloved two-story red brick school where generations of children have gathered to learn and play and grow up together. The gunman paced the sidewalk, a cell phone in his hand. Moments earlier, as he had shifted his aim from the green metal door to the playground, his .40-caliber pistol jammed, ending his rampage 12 seconds after it began. Now Principal Denise Fredericks and some of her staff congregated at the end of a second-floor hallway to keep track of him until help arrived. Then he looked up. "That's Jesse Osborne," a teacher gasped. He was 14 years old. Jesse had attended Townville, walked its halls, and romped on its playground through fifth grade before he transferred and was later homeschooled. Not once, Frederick said, had his behavior prompted concern. He was quiet, earned good grades, and almost never got into trouble. He played catcher in the recreation league. He got invited to birthday parties. Jesse had called his grandmother, Patsy Osborne, just minutes before he'd driven to the school that afternoon. He was screaming, she said. She couldn't understand him. Patsy and her husband, Thomas, sped to his house, where they discovered their son, Jesse's father, slumped on the couch, eyes still open. He'd been shot to death. Thomas later pulled up to the school just moments after Jesse had been subdued by an armed volunteer firefighter, arriving in time to see his handcuffed grandson loaded into the back of a patrol car. Inside the school, 300 children and teachers cowered in locked classrooms, bathrooms, and storage closets. Sienna remembered someone covering up windows with paper. Carson remembered playing with markers and magnets. Ava remembered a teacher reading a story about sunflowers. They all remembered the sound of weeping. A week later, on a Wednesday morning in October, Jacob lay inside a miniature gray casket topped with yellow chrysanthemums and a Ninja Turtle figurine. He was dressed in a Batman costume. His family had asked that people attending the service dress like superheroes because of the boys' infatuation with them. Ava wore a Ninja Turtle's top with a purple cape. Sienna and Colin both dressed as Captain America. From their seats, the children watched as Jacob's mom staggered to his casket, then collapsed on the floor. They stared at his body was wheeled up the center aisle at the end of the memorial. Then, just hours after their friend's funeral, they returned for the first time to the place he'd been shot. "What if he gets out?" Sienna asked her parents in the days after the shooting. Then she never stopped asking. They explained that Jesse Osborne was in jail, that she was safe. But still, Sienna obsessed over him coming for her again. Next to a sign beside her top bunk that read, "Night, night, sweet pea, sweet dreams," she relived the shooting in her nightmares. Each morning included a negotiation with her parents. "I don't want to go to school today," she would say. "I don't feel good." At drop-off, she would search the parking lot for the cruiser or the police officer assigned to Townville Elementary after the shooting. She needed to know he was there. One day, Sienna announced to her mother that she couldn't go to summer camp anymore. "They don't have a police officer." Like many of her classmates, she was petrified by loud, unexpected sounds. Once, outside a public supermarket, a car backfired, and she dropped to the ground before dashing inside. Another time, after a balloon popped at a school dance, the entire gymnasium went silent as Principal Fredericks rushed to turn the lights on. She later banned balloons at the spring festival. "Noises are different now," she said. A month after the shooting, Carson was beginning to sleep and eat normally again, but a sense of guilt still haunted him. "Maybe I should have waited on Jacob," he told his mother. "He could have jumped over the fence with me." She insisted that he couldn't have saved Jacob's life, but Carson wouldn't be persuaded. He stood half a foot taller than his friend, whom he'd known since they were toddlers. Big kids were supposed to help little ones. He didn't like it when people mentioned Jacob's name. For Valentine's Day, Carson wrote a card in his memory. "I loved him, but he died, but he's still a life in my heart." In the corner of his room, behind a bunk bed covered with Paw Patrol sheets, Colin rummaged through a plastic toy bin. His medical boot had come off months earlier, and the bullet wound had healed, leaving a dark nickel-sized splotch on his ankle. He could run again, though sometimes he had to take breaks because of the pain. Colin found what he was searching for and held up a plastic pistol. "His gun looked like that," he said, his tone matter-of-fact. Of all the children who survived that day, Colin seemed the most vulnerable to psychological damage in the eyes of many Townville parents and teachers. Before learning to tie his shoes, he'd been shot and seen his friends covered in blood. But he didn't have nightmares, and he didn't think much about Jesse. At school, as long as one of his stuffed animals was within reach, he felt fine. His father, a 200-pound construction worker, broke down about what had happened more often than Colin did. It wasn't that the boy didn't care, because he did, especially for Jacob's 4-year-old sister, Zoe, whom he'd often hug when he saw her. But Colin, now 7, can discuss that day with clarity and composure. Researchers who have studied kids for years still aren't certain why they react to trauma in such different ways. Perhaps no one understands that better than Nelba Marquez Green, whose son survived the Sandy Hook massacre but whose daughter did not. That's a factor you can't predict. How your child is going to deal with it, said Marquez Green, a family therapist for the past 13 years. She warned, however, that parents can't assume their kids have escaped the after effects, which sometimes don't surface for years. We still have this tendency to want to say, okay, it's done, he's good, she's good, Marquez Green said. That's not where the story ends. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. We're on the health and science page now. A newly identified asteroid threat. As if there weren't enough to worry about, European astronomers have discovered a new swarm of asteroids that have the potential to devastate Earth. New research reveals that asteroids nearly 1,000 feet wide are lurking within a previously unknown part of the Taurid meteor shower, a stargazer's favorite. CNET.com reports. Czech astronomers analyzed the 2015 Taurid shower, which produces a display of shooting stars when Earth passes through the trail of debris left by the disintegration of Comet Encke. Most of these rocks are small meteoroids that vaporize when they enter Earth's atmosphere, but some larger fragments may not disintegrate completely, raising the risk for impact. Inside that cloud of small objects, the Czech researchers discovered two large asteroids between 650 and 980 feet in diameter. These particular space rocks aren't on a collision course with Earth, but astronomers warn there are probably even larger asteroids hidden within the Taurid shower whose paths we don't know. That raises the possibility one could intersect Earth's orbit with a catastrophic impact large enough to wipe out all life on entire continents. We hope that people with access to large telescopes will explore this region in detail, says study author Jiří Borovička. Earth's next encounter with the newly discovered branch of the Taurid stream will occur in 2022. Olive oil boosts the brain. Nutritionists have long touted the heart-healthy benefits of olive oil, but a new study suggests this superfood and its powerful antioxidants may also act to protect the brain from tumors. Researchers at the University of Edinburgh homed in on a key ingredient in olive oil known as oleic acid. The team performed tests on living cells and human cell extracts to assess the effects of this fatty acid on a brain molecule called microRNA-7 that helps stop the growth of tumors. They found that oleic acid prevents a protein known as MSI2, from halting the production of microRNA-7. By indirectly supporting this tumor-blocking molecule, oleic acid may ultimately help prevent the growth and spread of cancer, reports NatureWorldNews.com. Our findings do suggest that oleic acid can support the production of tumor-suppressing molecules in cells grown in the lab. Further studies could help determine the role that olive oil might have in brain health. On the Talking Points page, Kelly, did she promote or expose Jones? Where's the line between covering a scoundrel as a news figure and giving him a promotional platform, said Jim Ruttenberg in the New York Times. That's the question hanging over new NBC host Megyn Kelly this week after she interviewed deranged conspiracy theorist Alex Jones on her news magazine Sunday Night with Megyn Kelly. Aside from what seemed like a blatant grab for attention and ratings, said Don Kaplan in the New York Daily News, there was no good reason to hand over NBC's primetime audience to Jones, a frightening, sweaty, tinfoil hat-wearing nut job who, through his website, Infowars.com, has made a small fortune peddling crackpot claims. Among them, Hillary Clinton ran a child sex trafficking ring in the basement of a Washington, D.C. pizzeria, and the massacre of 20 children at Sandy Hook Elementary School was a hoax. Worse, Kelly put a spotlight on Jones' ugly lies on Father's Day, even as still grieving parents in Newtown, Connecticut, pleaded with her not to go with the story. What an insult. Jones may be a reprehensible character, said Charlie Wartzel in BuzzFeed.com, but he is wildly popular. Infowars.com pulled in 476 million views during 2016. Jones' followers were early supporters of Donald Trump's unlikely candidacy, and Trump himself appears on Infowars in December 2015, telling Jones, "Your reputation is amazing." Ignoring Jones would be journalistically irresponsible, said Jack Schaefer in Politico.com, and Kelly took the con man apart. She forced him to admit that the Newtown conspiracy theory and others he's promoted were wrong, called him on his dodges, and left him red-faced, stammering, and sweating. Short of waterboarding him, I don't know what more Kelly could have done to expose Jones' dark methods. Kelly may have exposed Jones, said Amy Davidson in The New Yorker, but she missed the larger story. His crackpot beliefs have an increasingly wide currency, reaching right into the Oval Office. Jones and Trump bonded over the Obama birther fraud, and when InfoWars went off on paranoid rants about yogurt company Chobani bringing criminals and sex offenders to work at its Idaho plants, Jones was echoing the president's intimations about Mexican rapists. The Clinton pedophile ring was just an extreme version of the anti-Hillary conspiracy theories Trump embraced and promoted. InfoWars' paranoid conspiracy theories are no longer on the fringe. They are what the president, and increasingly some elements of his party, are all about. Cuba. Trump rolls back Obama's opening. President Trump's rollback of the Obama administration's rapprochement with Cuba is yet another foreign policy blunder, said Daniel Kurtz Phelan in NYMag.com. Trump last week reintroduced restrictions that bar Americans from traveling to Cuba without a licensed tour group and make it harder to do business there, in particular banning transactions with GAESA, a powerful corporate arm of the Cuban military. Reversing Obama's one-sided deal, Trump claimed, would pressure the Castro regime to make human rights reforms. In fact, the president resurrected one of the most glaring failures of American Cold War policy, which actually helped strengthen the Castro regime's grip on power. Since Obama opened up Cuba, many more Cubans have cell phones and internet access, while hundreds of thousands have become entrepreneurs and small business owners. Now, by pandering to a sliver of the Republican base, Miami's aging, fervently anti-Castro Cuban exiles, the president will succeed only in keeping the Cuban people isolated. Trump is right to recalibrate this policy without jettisoning it, said the Miami Herald in an editorial. Though we're not enamored of his limitations on booming U.S. travel to Cuba, cutting off GAESA, which controls 60% of the Cuban economy, will stem the money flowing into Raul Castro regime that has given very little on human rights. The opening to Cuba was a return to an old, discredited policy of embracing Latin American dictators at the behest of corporate businesses, said Frank Calzone in USAtoday.com. While U.S. companies and tourists rushed into Cuba, beatings and political detentions increased dramatically while Obama looked the other way. Now Trump has a message for Havana. If you want American millions, your anti-American foreign policy and repression at home must change. Trump's passion for human rights is selective, said Kevin Liptak and Dan Marika in CNN.com. He praises Vladimir Putin for being a strong leader and excuses his killings of dissidents and journalists. He did a sword dance and bowed to the Saudi king and said, "We are not here to lecture the Saudis about human rights." Despite the royal family's routine beheadings and oppression of dissidents and women, Trump lavished praise on Chinese leader Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago, never uttering a word about his authoritarian regime's jailing of dissidents and strict censorship of the internet. So, why does Cuba offend him? A couple of short notes. The U.S. is as divided in its technological progress as in its politics. About 39% of the U.S. rural population, 23 million people, lacked access to broadband internet service, compared with 4% of urban residents. Without broadband, rural residents have slow, unreliable service. And we'll just go on to a quote. This comes from our former president, Theodore Roosevelt, quoted in NPR.org. He says, "Americans learn only from catastrophe, not from experience." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.